Welcome back once again. I'm Jeff Rutsch here with you, six nights a week, 3 hours a night, coast to coast on radio stations around these United States and on the internet live worldwide. And do remember, all of these programs are available for you on our archives, CourtesyBroadcast.com, through my website at sightings.com. As many of you know, last month, February 17th to be exact, NBC Television aired its two-hour primetime much promoted special entitled and predicated on Whitley Strieber's newest book called Confirmation. It was, of course, sweeps week, and the networks were certainly trying to attract the maximum audience possible. The special succeeded in that regard with the general public, to be sure, but not with the critics in the mainstream media. Professor Lawrence Krauss, in fact, kicked off a small deluge of very negative reviews in the media across this country with his cutting piece in the New York Times, dated February the 22nd. The piece was so searing and was followed by many others of similar bent that I, at one point, thought about getting a couple of folks on the show to discuss this. Joe Mergia down in Florida suggested I get Mr. Krauss himself and was instrumental in arranging that, and we do have tonight Professor Lawrence Krauss, the author of that article, and to discuss this with him on more than friendly terms, of course, is physicist Stanton Friedman, who has been investigating the UFO phenomenon for nearly 40 years now, and if anyone is qualified to sit down with anyone to talk about the pros of the business of UFOs and ETs, it would be certainly Stan Friedman. Many of you know Stan, who has been a frequent guest on this program for nearly 6 years now, but let me tell you a bit about Professor Lawrence Krauss. He has some remarkable credentials, and I want you to understand exactly where he's coming from in terms of mainstream science. Professor Krauss is an internationally known theoretical physicist with wide research interests, including the interface between elementary particle physics and cosmology, where his studies include the early universe, the nature of dark matter, general relativity, and neutrino astrophysics. He has investigated questions ranging from the nature of exploding stars to issues of the origin of all mass in the universe. He was born in New York City and moved shortly thereafter to Toronto, Canada, where he grew up. He received undergraduate degrees in both mathematics and physics at Carleton University. He received his Ph.D. in physics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1982, and then joined the Harvard Society of Fellows for 3 years. He joined the faculty of the Departments of Physics and Astronomy at Yale as assistant professor in 1985 and associate professor in 88. In 1993, he was named the Ambrose Swayze Professor of Physics, Professor of Astronomy, and Chairman of the Department of Physics at Case Western Reserve University as well. He is the author of over 170 scientific publications and at least 4 books, of which we'll mention tonight. And we're very glad to have Professor Krauss with us. Hello, are you there, Larry?
Yes, I'm there. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Now, our friend Stanton Friedman has been introduced so many times in this program. Let me say just in brief summation again, Stan is a physicist. He has worked with nuclear propulsion systems. He has worked at security clearance levels with all the major defense contractors seemingly of importance at one time or another. He is an author. He has given probably close to 1,000 lectures around the world on this subject over the years, and it's good to have Stan back on the program again. And there's something you two have in common, Stan and Lawrence, that's very interesting. Are you there, Stan?
Yes, I'm here.
Both of you are 4 time zones east of me in California. Now, think about that.
No, wait a minute now. If Larry's in Cleveland and I'm in New Brunswick, Canada, I'm 4 and he's only 3.
Now, hold on. Get this. Sit this on the table, Stan. Larry, go ahead.
Well, I'm on the board of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia right now.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
I didn't know that. Okay.
I'm in Amherst, Nova Scotia at this point, which is just about 3 miles from the border.
Yeah.
Now, Stan, you're notoriously close to the American border, too.
I'm closer than he is.
I'm close to the New Brunswick border. He's close to the American border.
How funny. Well, anyway, you guys are both very much, I'm grateful you're here tonight, very much putting up, staying up late, 4 hours. It's 7:10 here on the West Coast or thereabout, and you can add 4 to that, folks, and figure it out. The name of Professor Krauss's New York Times editorial, and it really caught me flat-footed because I thought there would at least be one or two nice things said about this special, which was a very diverse presentation of a lot of pretty interesting things, even if you don't agree with the way it was presented, and some didn't, some did. There was some very provocative material there, not the least of which would be Stan Friedman's Talking Head segment. But that's another story we'll get to. The entitled piece by Professor Krauss is Stop the Flying Saucer, I Want to Get Off. And that caught my attention. I read that, and we'll get to pieces of that as we continue. But that was just the first of a number of mainstream media, rather negative, to say the least, reviews of this particular two-hour effort on network television. Okay, Mr. Krauss, sir, since you're the guest of honor, who I called first tonight, only to that regard, we'll get you on here first and tell us why this particular program left you so put out, so to speak.
Well, I think the reason was it began with the title, Confirmation, the Hard Evidence. On a mainstream network like NBC, to present such a title, and then the promos for it presenting would look to me to be, again, the sort of standard dubious stuff to encourage people to watch TV, but not to be the same kind of incisive journalism you'd expect investigating the president at the same time. Really began to disturb me, and I realized, of course, it was Sweeps Week. And then when I watched, what I saw was not hard evidence. It was innuendo and interesting and mysterious things every now and then, but there are many interesting and mysterious things in the world, and they don't all have to do with aliens. And I thought that it, rather than... What really upset me the most, and I as you noted, I write a lot of popular books and... Mm-hmm. Articles. I really feel a need as a scientist to convey to people what science is all about. And what worries me is that people are much more gullible when it comes to scientific issues. Or much not gullible isn't really the word. Much less able to distinguish sense from nonsense than they are, say, with political issues. And so, by presenting material, albeit produced by the entertainment aspect of NBC and not the news aspect. But by presenting it as if it was news to a public which is really scientifically illiterate, I felt it was unfair, and that's why I came out with No Holds Barred.
By the way, some would take exception to one statement you've made already, that the American public is better able to discern and discriminate in terms of political issues than the two special...
But what I mean by that is they're more skeptical, I guess.
Okay.
In the sense that they're skeptical of politicians, and I think they're skeptical of journalists, too.
So you're saying is there's a knee-jerk reflex toward embracing this kind of material you find uncomfortable?
Exactly. Not an ability to present it through the same kind of filter, yeah.
Is it partly a factor, though, of not a lot of hard science to go on? Is it that? We do have, at least in terms of politics, more palpable things to grab. We're dealing with, to most people, an intangible issue here.
Well, yeah, but I think, this is just one aspect of a far broader subject. I presented one of the stunning statistics in that piece that amazed me from a National Science Foundation study that 50% of American adults basically do not know that the Earth goes around the sun and takes a year to do it.
Excuse me?
50% of American adults questioned by this National Science Foundation study do not know that the Earth goes around the sun and takes a year to do it.
Well, not a good sign, as they say.
Yeah.
Stan, and you look back on this special now, it's been over a month, how does it fit in your craw?
Well, I wasn't horribly contented with the special, because there is indeed a lot of hard data that wasn't presented on the program, but, I did my homework, I hope. I read Dr. Krauss's book, Beyond Star Trek, which has a lot of stuff about UFOs in it. Supposedly about UFOs in it, and I was distressed. I'm in agreement with them that the public does have trouble distinguishing fact from fiction about science, but so does Dr. Krauss in his book. He knows nothing about flying saucers. There are no references.
You're absolutely correct. I do not pretend to be an expert on flying saucers. I do, however, at least claim to be an expert on physics, and what I try to do...
But that part in the book... You do comment at length that, after all, the cover says from alien invasion to the end of time, that it's and UFOs are in the index and so forth.
Yes.
But you haven't done your homework. There's not only no references, but when you do talk about UFOs, something specific, you don't get it right.
Well, at least I get the physics right. I think that's...
Oh, you don't!
Well, you know, that, basic
let's
things...
Look at something
excuse me.
Let me not
basic things such as objects which have trajectories that are right angles in the air going from twice the speed of sound to being at rest in a tenth of a second have g-forces of 700 times the force of gravity. And that's
your
law, and there's no dispute or anything in that regard. And the kind of forces that you would experience in such an object would be equivalent to a 35-ton weight falling on your head.
Right.
Okay, all right.
Wait.
We have to go to a break now, gentlemen. Hold on right there. All right, very good. Good way to start. One quick question before we do pause. Larry, have you ever seen Stan's lecture, at least on video?
No.
I want him
my books? Has he read my papers? Has he read any
now,
of them?
Stan's Stan, hold on. Stan has one up on you. He's read one of your books.
I appreciate that.
I want him to send you a video, and I want you to look at it, at least for me, and that'll be interesting.
Oh, right. I'd be happy to.
Good. All right, we have to pause, and we'll come right back and continue with Professor Lawrence Krauss and Stanton Friedman here tonight as we discuss Mr. Krauss's article in the New York Times called Stop the Flying Saucer, I Want to Get Off. Okay, welcome back, everybody. I'm Jeff Lentz. Very happy to have with me tonight Stan Friedman, our longtime associate colleague and friend, and Professor Lawrence Krauss, who wrote that editorial in the New York Times. Dr. Krauss has written many more things besides that, as I mentioned, over 170 other publications and papers, including four books, one of which was mentioned and has been read by Stan Friedman, called Beyond Star Trek. He also wrote The Physics of Star Trek, Fear of Physics, and The Fifth Essence. All of those available in bookstores, subtitled Dark Matter in the Universe, I should add. So outstanding books by a remarkable man, Lawrence Krauss, and an equally remarkable man, Stan Friedman, is here. Let's, for fun, guys, just talk about the physics of the idea of an object moving, as you suggested, at incredible velocities and coming to a dead stop, the equivalent, as you said, Larry, of a 35-ton weight coming to rest on the occupants inside. Stan, explain to Larry your understanding of how something like that might be accomplished.
Well, he doesn't understand that the amount of acceleration that people can stand, and he talks about a limit of about 8 G's, which is not true. A trained pilot can perform a tracking task while being accelerated at 14 G's for 2 minutes, can stand 30 G's for a second, and apparently a great deal more than that for a short, much shorter period of time. Right angle turns don't take very long.
Neither do collisions with the ground, which is what I estimated was the equivalent g-force you'd experience in the instant of collision
but
with the ground from, say, falling at 1,000 feet. And it's true, it doesn't take very long, but it doesn't take very long to die.
Let's Stan lay out his position here, and we'll get to you later.
The kicker here is that if you draw a curve of maximum acceptable G-loading versus time, obviously the time gets shorter the more you can stand. And so we need specifics. He comes up with an arbitrary tenth of a second, and for a spacecraft, nobody's saying flying saucers are spacecraft. They could be brought here by a mothership. In other words, the little ones aren't the same as the big ones. Aircraft carriers and little airplanes. Certainly aircraft carriers can't perform the same maneuvers that the airplanes can that are carried on them. But his approach on the physics of flying saucers, which is admittedly what's talked about several times here, is roughly the same as Dr. Campbell, a good Canadian, incidentally, University of Western Ontario professor of astronomy. He showed that the required initial launch weight of a chemical rocket able to get a man to the moon and back after pages of equations, this was published in 1941, he showed that the maximum, the weight at liftoff, maximum weight, if you will, would have to be a million tons. He was only off by a factor of 300 million because he made all the wrong assumptions about all the aspects of getting a man to the moon. He assumed a single-stage rocket, for example. He assumed the limitation of 1 G.
Well, that's very interesting. However, it's irrelevant.
Hold on, Larry. Let me finish.
Legitimate. And that's what Dr. Krause has done all throughout his discussion of UFOs and physics. Let me give you another example, closer to home, well, for him it is anyway, and it was for him years ago. He talks about NASA Lewis considering nuclear rockets, which use hydrogen as the propellant. You heat the hydrogen in the rocket, you kick it out the back end. He says they're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't tell you, in the late 60s, they tested a whole bunch of them. They, meaning contractors for NASA, actually, not NASA itself. I worked on those programs. The biggest one had a power level of 4,400 megawatts. That's twice the power of, say, the point of problem nuclear generating station right here in New Brunswick. That's reality. It has
In fact, I argue that was one of the more realistic aspects of space travel, not like warp drive or...
That's right, but you talk about nuclear fusion correctly, an interesting approach. You don't talk about deuterium and helium-3, which gives you charged particles. And the fact that there were good studies done, NASA money, of course, and Air Force money, back in the 60s, I worked on some in the early 60s, using deuterium and helium-3, not deuterium and deuterium.
Sure.
Heavy hydrogen and deuterium for our listeners, anyway. Those studies come up with rather different results than the ones to which you refer.
The results regarding what? The fuel requirements to travel at half the speed of light? I'm afraid not.
They certainly do. You've made the assumption that the specifics of the system design and trajectory, the whole approach to how you get someplace, don't matter, that you can do it from basic physics. And any study of our technological progress shows that that simply isn't true.
No, I think you're right in one sense, but you're wrong in another. You can never violate basic physics. You can exploit it and be tricky and be a wonderful engineer and utilize it and obtain the maximum efficiency. But if basic physical constraints on the energy requirements of a system are sound, then you'll never be able to violate those. And in nuclear fusion, the energy release is such that every single one of the objects that leaves the fusion travels at less than 3% of the speed of light. And very simple constraints tell you that you can't use those things for propulsion to get to half the speed of light without using a hell of a lot of them. And I think you would agree with that.
Presuming that you have to provide all the energy.
What do you mean I have to provide the energy? The energy has to come from somewhere.
Sure, but when we go to the moon, when we go to Jupiter, when we go to Saturn, we use cosmic freeloading all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
That's an enormous difference.
Absolutely, except the gravitational potentials in our galaxy are 1 part in 10 to the 6. They're not going to get you anywhere near the speed of light. The speed of the sun in our galaxy is 200 kilometers per second. It's nothing compared to the speed of light. You can't use gravity in our galaxy to help you at all. You can use gravity in the solar system to produce velocities which are comparable to the velocities of planets, which is the reason we use use gravity precisely for ejecting objects from the solar system and for, in fact, traveling to distant planets. That's absolutely correct. However, it's irrelevant for traveling through the galaxy.
The point is not irrelevant that you use what energy is there and you don't have to provide it all. Find a convenient black hole if you want.
You could try and find a convenient black hole. We could talk about that if you want.
Okay, hold on, folks, and we'll talk about that and much more. We're going to take our bottom-of-the-hour break, and remind you, Professor Lawrence Krauss is here along with Stan Friedman, and we'll be right back. We are back, and we are pleased to have two formidable intellects jousting and presenting their views tonight. Gentlemen, both of you, if you can not try to step on each other's words quite as often, we'll have a little smoother ability for everyone to grab onto this. We're talking about gravity, which is a whole program in and of itself, of course. What is gravity? Can gravity be used for propulsion within the atmosphere and general vicinity of the Earth? Or is gravity something else? Is it something electromagnetic? Is it something that can be accessed? As Bob Lazar says, there are two types of gravity waves, A and B, but that's another story. If you go to the U.S. Patent Office, and certainly Stan has been there enough, I imagine that Professor Krauss, you've spent more than your share of time there as well, We go back all the way to 1962 to the very famous Townsend Brown patent for the electrokinetic transducer, which really opened the door, many people say, to exotic modes of propulsion. Then we move forward to 1987, the James Cox dipolar force field propulsion system. This is a dipolar force field system having an alternating electronic field source for producing electromotive lines of force. Fascinating. And then we move forward to the most recent of interest, at least that which appears in the patent office. That would be James Taylor's 1993 patent applied for 1992, which is an electromagnetic energy propulsion system, which would theoretically be capable of making those pieces of hardware, Larry, move at the angles and directions and tangents that we've talked about so many times over the years and you alluded to earlier would be impossible for humans to sustain viability within. Now, you're familiar with all these.
Well, I mean, I'm familiar with some of them, but what I'm particularly familiar with is that patents mean nothing, is that the patent office doesn't require something to work.
I understand
just,
that.
And in fact, I know, I was just at a meeting with someone you probably have on the program, James Randi, recently at the American Physical Society, going over patents by a number of people, including the last person you mentioned, who have machines that will produce energy from nothing. Great, wonderful ideas. The trouble is they're nonsense. Yep. I mean, they really are literally nonsense. The fact that something is nonsense does not stop it from having a patent. So I don't think one can argue on the basis of patents.
No, we don't do that.
On the basis of experiments that are verified by...
Repeatedly,
exactly.
I understand. No, it's a very good point. We do not pretend to suggest that these patents imply or don't necessarily connote viability.
Absolutely.
But they are fascinating to read, and many people suggest that... they may just be, in fact, operational. We don't know what the black ops folks are really doing. Stan, your comment on this?
Well, I agree that a patent obviously doesn't mean you can build a thing, and there are a lot of beautiful drawings and patents that I've seen that nobody has reduced to practice. I am more interested in the physics work of people like Hal Puthoff, for example, and Haish, Bernard Haish, I guess it is.
Well, yeah, that's right, both of them.
About vacuum energy, or the energy of the vacuum, or... call it what you will, there are a few other names kicking around.
Yes.
But I'm much more concerned about the fact that a basic assumption...
Can I just interrupt you 1 second, by the way, and say that those things are quite interesting, and I also believe those things I study in great detail and talk to them about, and in fact, they are, in my opinion, also scientific nonsense.
Well, they have been published, at least in physics.
Yeah, that's right. If you know also, as a physicist, being published is not...
That's not necessarily, yes.
And up above top stuff, if you will, but... Let me get back to my concerns here. Page 16 of your book, you talk about the famous sighting at Roswell. Wasn't a sighting at Roswell that's famous? It was a crash there. Entirely different thing. I wish somebody had seen it come down.
No one has ever claimed sighting.
I wish someone had seen it, too, because I agree.
You
the fact that it wasn't seen makes it even more implausible.
What's more implausible? That it's
because no one saw it, you suggested.
I mean, it would be, you know, seeing it would certainly be one step up up from myth.
Okay, so you're feeling
it's
exciting with a car.
You haven't talked to any of the witnesses, have you, who saw the vehicle wreckage on the ground?
I've heard, you know, the point is that you certainly, sir, have studied these things much more than me, and I don't want to pretend in any way to have studied these particular issues in great detail. And I'm sure that people who've seen things have seen real things. The question is, have they seen anything that relates to aliens? And my central issue is, if you consider the physics behind the likelihood of traveling through interstellar space, you will find, when you consider that physics, that the likelihood is so small that almost any other plausible explanation for almost every other mysterious phenomenon that's seen is more plausible than the assumption that aliens can exist.
But you just said is totally unscientific. You cannot compute the likelihood of strange events happening, if you will.
It's strange events happen all the time.
It's calculators.
No, that's right. Strange events happen.
Larry, hold on, Larry, please. Larry, just a minute. Let's Stan talk.
Sure. Look, you've taken the assumption that if you can't figure out how it can be done, it can't be done, therefore it's unlikely. You can determine likelihood if you've got a pair of dice, for example, and you know how many pips are on each side. We'd agree on that. Certain throws, it's easier to get a 7 than a 2 if you got a pair of dice. These are things you can determine likelihood, flipping the plane and so forth. But that there will be technology, which presently sounds absurd, 2 months or 2 years from now or 200 years or 2 million years from now, to say that that's unlikely the facts indicate that technological progress almost invariably comes doing things differently in an unpredictable way.
Absolutely. And remember, we're suggesting that we aren't the folks doing this technology either. It's somebody else out there who is well in advance of us.
I agree with you completely, and I try never, in fact, to argue that something that we don't know about is either possible or impossible. There's a lot more we don't know about the universe than we do. And so, but, you know, I hear that a lot. People say to me, well, 400 years ago, people would never have dreamed we would have flown. And that's absolutely right. And had anyone 400 years ago said flying is impossible, or 100 years ago, as some people did, say flying is impossible, they were speaking out of turn. But what I do like to point out to people is that while there's a tremendous amount we don't know about the universe, there's a tremendous amount we do know about the universe. And if someone talks to me and tries to use arguments based on physics, not that we don't understand, but physics that we really do understand, and they get it totally wrong, then that's the wonderful thing about science, is it determines what is nonsense based on experiments that we can do now. So you could talk to me all about things we don't understand right now, but if you start talking to me about electromagnetism or gravity or things that at the level that are relevant here, we understand and can test in the laboratory, and not you, sir, but if anyone else makes claims that disagree with the experiments that could be performed in the laboratory,
I can say it will not
only be implausible, but impossible.
All right, coming up on a break, and we're going to pause. When we come back, we'll have Stan's input on this, and later on, if we have time, we'll take a call or two. The issue of extrasolar planets, Larry, and certainly Stan knows, is a big one now. We've got 17 what appear to be planets that we've already discovered, and more are coming in regularly now. Gosh, in 5 or 10 years, we may have hundreds of them out there.
Oh, absolutely.
Unlimited potential for other life to have evolved out there to bring physics here that we are not aware of yet, of course, and that would explain, I think you'd agree, Larry, what we're seeing potentially in the skies as being unsustainable movement for humans. That's not a problem.
Well, I certainly would agree that there's probably tons of life in our galaxy.
Yeah,
that I would agree with.
Very good. All right, we'll pause and come right back with Stan Friedman and Larry Cross. That nice calming music. Very nice. All right, gentlemen, we're going to get back at this, but let me submit one thing here. Patents, either workable or pipe dreams, are on the books. Some of them are remarkably well-researched, at least. They are provocative. They present issues of physics which warrant certainly all of our consideration. The 1993 patent from Ernest Shearing out of Porterville, California, who was originally, I guess, when did he submit this? 1991. It provides a protective enclosure for vehicles propelled by magnetic propulsion systems. Let me just read this one little section to you. Summary of the invention, briefly and in general terms, the present invention provides for a protective enclosure for space vehicle with a magnetic propulsion system. The protective enclosure formed by an insulated DEWAR Dewar vessel surrounded on all sides by superconducting walls which shield the interior of the enclosure from external magnetic and electric fields. The superconducting enclosure is also surrounded by superconducting magnets which serve to cushion passengers or crew within the enclosure from acceleration and gravitational forces by inducement of eddy currents in the superconducting enclosure walls. Professor Krauss?
Well, until it got to gravity, it wasn't didn't sound completely crazy. Indeed, superconductors do a very good job of shielding against magnetic fields. Magnetic fields, of course, are not very strong at all. They're kind of in the region of the Earth. We don't use them very much for propulsion. But gravitational fields don't produce any eddy currents and aren't shielded by anything superconducting. And therefore, a superconductor doesn't shield you against any kind of gravitational acceleration anyway, shape, or form. It would indeed shield you against magnetic fields if you were ever worried about magnetic fields. But I think if you think about both the literature and your experience, you'll find that not many people have been either moved about or dramatically affected one way or another by magnetic field.
All right. Sam, any comment on that?
Really, that isn't really true. There are electromagnetic submarine propulsion systems that have been operated.
Oh, sure. You can do electromagnetic propulsion, absolutely, by generating large electromagnetic fields.
Okay.
Right.
Larry, let's let Stan go off on this.
If you ionize the air, you can interact with electric and magnetic fields, and you can control all the problems of high-speed flight. You can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom protection, production, radar profiles, all those sorts of things. There's a whole world there of magneto-aerodynamics. Mm-hmm. It certainly doesn't sound like that patent you were just saying, Jim. But in my congressional testimony, I referred to a lot of this kind of work that's gone on. Some of it was, most of it was classified, at least back then. That was 69. But again, I want to turn this around. If you're going to talk about flying saucers, you have to study the data relevant to flying saucers, not say, since it can't be, there's no point in studying the data. There is data to be studied.
So let me get this straight, Stan. What you're saying is we must separate our known understanding of physics when we look at the flying saucer enigma to give it a fair shake and then later integrate it if possible.
Well, yeah, I mean, let me give you a specific example. Okay. You could design a vehicle to go from New Brunswick, an internal combustion engine system, power system, to go from New Brunswick, Canada, let's say, to Los Angeles. And depending on the assumptions you make about how you go about that trip, you will come up with very, very different vehicles. For example, you could assume that you have to carry all the oxygen and all the propellant for the entire trip when you take off, and you'd wind up with a huge monster.
Absolutely.
But the student says, hey, why don't you stop for gas every 300 miles? Why don't you use the oxygen that's in the air instead of carrying it along? Take advantage of the real world, and then you wind up with something like a car instead of an aircraft carrier.
Absolutely.
The assumptions make all the difference in the world.
Well, I agree.
And so what we need to do is to do that with the data about flying saucers. There are 10 PhD theses that have been done. There are 5 large-scale scientific studies that I talk about in my life. There's no hint of these in any of the discussion. You talk about Kenneth Arnold, famous sighting, page 16, Beyond Star Trek, for those who are looking at the handbook. And I recommend buying the book. You call him a commercial pilot, seeing spin and talk about spinning discs above Mount Rainier. That's nonsense. He was a private pilot. The discs weren't spinning. He saw 9 of them, and he timed their flight between 2 mountains, mountain peaks, and came up with a speed like 1,200 miles.
You know, that may be, you know, that may be absolutely true. Of course, the fact that it is irrelevant to the other discussion. I don't discuss his particular sighting or non-sighting. I just introduced it there as
But I think the point, Larry, is that
didn't do your homework.
Dan is bringing it up. It's not just minutia that is being thrown around carelessly. Stan is a real sticker for research, and he would like to see it done properly. That's what he's pointing out to you.
Yeah,
he's
going to
talk about Arnold. He's going to talk about him right.
From an article I read, but whether they were spinning or not spinning, or whether he was a commercial pilot or a private pilot. Actually, I probably did him a service by calling him a commercial pilot because I suppose it made him more credible a witness.
Okay, but let me ask you a question, Larry. Have you ever really sat down and studied the Arnold sighting per se? And this is not to discount anything you've said. I'm just curious.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not, and I don't claim to have done so.
Would you like to study this a little bit more just to get a feel for the other side, a little more
palpably?
Or is it not worth your time?
I just think based on the general arguments that I and pretty well all my colleagues come up with, I think unless convinced by some compelling piece of evidence that I don't know about, and that it's not worth my time.
Well, but then why do you talk about something about which you know nothing because you haven't felt it was worth your while to study what?
What I didn't talk about there, sir, is physics, and that I know something about.
But you don't.
And I don't think
know
my
anything
point
about
that. I understand.
Saucers,
my point here is that one can study. I haven't studied the O.J. Simpson trial in detail either. There's lots of things I haven't studied in detail, but I can ask myself general questions, as I think every educated person can ask themselves, and say based on those general questions, do I believe that there's a likelihood that this will be true? I believe the likelihood, based on my general assumptions about the O.J. Simpson trial, the likelihood is that he's guilty. Based on what I know from physics and those basic, simple arguments, which is what I love about physics, the fact that you don't have to look for the trees to understand the forest, that you can use general concepts like energy to give you general constraints independent of engineering, general constraints
on what you can and cannot do. And then I say to myself, I don't try and say this is impossible. I say, what would be required for this to be possible?
In
What would require for a fusion engine to generate propulsion if you brought the fuel on board? Those kind of questions you can ask yourself.
Okay, let me stop you right there. Stan, the issue seems to be Larry Krauss is clearly a brilliant man, but has not been at all exposed to the data, as you know it, and as many of the professionals who've been doing this for decades, Larry, decades they've been pouring their lives into this. This is not an O.J. Simpson verdict. This is a lifelong pursuit of knowledge. And I think it's very important that you might want to open up a little bit and take at least the time to think about what Stan is saying.
I periodically pick up those reviews. I even watched that silly program.
Well, no, we don't want you to do that. We want you to spend time with Stan Friedman.
Produces a program, and I'm supposed to see hard evidence, and I see innuendo.
Well, we're beyond that special right now. We're talking about...
If the evidence was there, why wouldn't it be presented in an NBC special?
Did you watch the Learning Channel during the next week?
I appear on the Learning Channel every night.
Well, then maybe you saw during the next week, there were 2 hours a night of really universally admired and praised extraordinary productions, documentaries about this issue of flying saucers, and they were just extraordinary. We wish that they had been, some of them, on NBC as well. Now, maybe you missed that, but that was a week-long series, and the Learning Channel scored terrific ratings.
Actually, they've been on one of those programs. So.
Okay.
Because physics of Star Trek was based on trying to say what neat physics is out there, and what's there in the real world, which is actually more interesting than science.
All right, we've got about 2 minutes. Go ahead, Stan.
Well, I wanted to call attention to the work of Dr. James E. McDonald, a professor of physics at the University of Arizona, especially with upper atmosphere physics, mm-hmm. which one would think might be related to what people see in the atmosphere. Jim's congressional testimony, for example, he had information on 41 separate cases that he had thoroughly investigated. I mean, he had talked to many, many, actually a total of over 500 witnesses. If you look at his cases, then you have to say that here's a mystery worthy of scientific attention that included multiple witness radar visual sightings, for example. Now, you might say that's impossible, so I'm not going to read it, but that's what they said to Gallo.
No, I wouldn't say it's impossible. I believe. I don't believe these people are lying. I believe that there are many times that there are mysteries that are honest mysteries. So therefore they're worth someone studying. Well, I don't understand why people jump to the assumption that when there's an honest mystery, it has to involve aliens. There are lots of mysteries of people's disappearances.
No, a lot of people
every
don't.
Day, and
a lot
I
of
just,
people
I don't.
Don't
people, I don't on that.
I don't jump to that at all.
No, a lot of people
look at
don't.
The evidence. I find we're dealing with manufactured objects, judging by how they look. You could say you could count the rivets. I don't know of anybody reporting rivets. Manufactured objects behaving in ways that we cannot yet duplicate, and where there are many reports involving these objects and strange beings together. The combination, in other words, most sightings can be explained. There's no question about that. That's not very useful. Most isotopes aren't fissionable either. If you want to build a reactor, you use the ones that are, and one really, primarily. So the ones that can be identified, the sightings that can be identified, really don't matter. What we want are the ones that can't be. Now, every large-scale scientific study, and I've seen no evidence that you've studied any of them, of the studies, not the individual cases, has shown a substantial number of cases where the appearance and the behavior say we're dealing with manufactured objects that outfly anything we had flying, especially 50 years ago. We're getting closer, I'll admit that. If we could build things that look like that and fly like that, we would.
Let me just jump in again one thing. I think
coming up on the NBR, Larry. Hold your point, please. We are out of time this hour. Stan, you got about 20 seconds. Go ahead.
What I'm saying is if you're going to reach a conclusion about flying saucers, you have to study the data relevant to flying saucers. The laws of physics are irrelevant in the sense that we have what is happening is happening.
Yeah.
Whether we understand or not, beside the point.
All right. We need to separate the serious scientific study from the pop UFO culture, I think. And we'll proceed with this discussion after this top of the hour break. See you in about 7 minutes.